Don't Look Up, directed by Adam McKay, is about two astronomers discovering that a Mount Everest-sized comet is due in 6 months' time to hit planet Earth and wipe out all human life. The scientists present their alarming findings to the White House and the press, only to find that political leaders and the media can't or won't grasp what the urgency of the situation. The film has been widely praised and reviled as a cautionary tale about the climate emergency and the forces that stand in the way of responding to the scale of the crisis. So Joe, Don't Look Up, like many Hollywood disaster films, starts with government officials ignoring the warnings of scientists, in this case, an astronomy professor and the woman graduate student who discovers the comet and its fateful trajectory. So let's start with how the film operates as a cautionary tale about climate change and media and government failures to heed the urgent warnings of scientists. What's your take on how the film works on that critical level?
Well, like a lot of films that have had this exact same plot structure, which is that it's discovered, it's brought to the attention of the political elite, but it seems like such a rare, if not non-existent kind of thing, that it's not taken seriously until they're able to make the data speak for itself. And in this film, they do something very similar. They have a campaign where they break out and they create public pressure to listen to the scientists. And eventually the political establishment embarks on what seems like a plan, the kind of standard go blow it up plan. What ends up happening is that plan is derailed. It is derailed by the capitalist class, represented by this billionaire figure, Peter Isherwell, played by Mark Rylance, very smarmy, but kind of soft-spoken old white guy. And he wants to mine the comet and exploit it for the trillions of dollars worth of rare earth metals and hundreds of trillions of dollars of other just more standard materials. And they are able to sway the government to abandon its straightforward mission to just solve the problem. And that is where the second take, shifting from disaster films to disaster capitalism, really shines in this film. It's about the absurdity of the inaction, but it's trying to draw a line between what could be happening and what is happening that is spelling out in a climate context a lot of what we see when it comes to the kinds of corporate strategies for dealing with climate change, from carbon markets to carbon capture to geoengineering and all this, that aren't about stopping the source of climate change, but constantly trying to keep up with its consequences. And I think people are resonating with the film around that particular like large story arc, because it's about trying to shake awake the real world as to what's going on before we get to the point where the comet ends up hitting the Earth and intervene in it, stop it, say no to it.
I think part of what makes the film work on an emotional level is the character of the young woman graduate student, astronomy graduate student, played by Jennifer Lawrence. And she is trying to present a rational argument about the scientific basis of her findings and the nature of the threat, that catastrophic threat that the government needs to respond to. But she's seen as kind of a downer by others, not a very effective media spokesperson, as a hysteric by conservatives. And I think a lot of her persona, her character in this film, channels feelings and emotions in the climate movement itself, feeling outrage, alarm, and despair over the failure of a meaningful government response to the crisis itself. Although then that leads me to follow the trajectory of her character over the course of the film, something we might also talk about. How does the film make use of the comet as a metaphor for climate crisis? And what is the trajectory, not only of the comet, but of the responses to those who are most alarmed?
Yeah, the comet is bringing the crisis in an inexorable way to humanity. And a lot of critics, and even McKay, have pointed to the social response to these existential crises is really kind of what is the problem in the film. The comet is just what it is, and it's moving forward, and it's going to complete its trajectory unless we do something to change that. With climate change, there is a much more reflexive thing going on where what we do will be what changes it, but that's not just one thing. We're not just going to go out and blow up one thing. And how do we collectively accomplish that one task? It's often remarked that climate change is this complex thing, and it has all of these different facets of mitigation and response. And the film scares some folks because it seems to suggest that we are collectively incapable of mounting that response, and is just in that way kind of pessimistic. But I don't know whether I agree with that, because I think the film is trying to deal with that whole dynamic itself in the way that it's split between the first part of the film where they get a plan ready to send out the space shuttles outfitted with nuclear bombs and just blow it up. And the derailing of that plan is, you know, what we're stuck with for the rest of the film. But this isn't the limit to what we can do. It's a comment on this line of action and thought that the capitalists introduce into the idea of responding to the crisis. And that really the film portrays a lot of lucidness from ordinary people when the question of like, there is this terrible thing coming, like people of several of the street scenes like will stop and say, wait, what are you talking about? It's a crisis of the political culture of the elites and of the larger, you know, upper part of society that works with them, which is in large part the media.
I would like to get back to the question of the comet as a metaphor for climate change. And I think you're right that by approaching climate change through a metaphor, it allows the audience to get a hold of something. It concretizes what's more elusive and provides a way to both talk about something while not talking about it, kind of opening up space for exploring themes that might be more difficult if it were directed to the audience as this is a film about climate change. But I also do feel that it's a misplaced metaphor in many ways, not only in the sense of, you know, does it correspond to the actual threat of climate change? And here McKay draws and has a company called Hyperobjects Industries, a media company that takes up the ideas of Timothy Morton, who's a philosopher who coined the term hyperobjects and has written about global warming, saying that the human mind is not has not evolved to grasp the scope of the climate problem. And so you can see how the work of Timothy Morton and this concept of hyperobject would lead to a kind of hyper-concretized way of approaching the crisis. And of course, there are differences in terms of the comet is an abrupt event and climate change is more gradual. But more than that, the comet is a natural disaster and it hits randomly. And with the climate crisis, it's not a random natural event. And the oil and gas industries have tried to portray it as a kind of a force of nature and an inevitable product of the modern world and the industrial age. And in that sense, I think it's a problematic metaphor and obscures, though one might say it may open space in another way to talk about what's really driving the death of much of life on the planet. But the fact that the climate crisis is driven by a relatively small group of corporate interests that have downplayed the threat and fostered denial or minimization of the climate crisis is itself eclipsed by the metaphor. And as a natural disaster, it does, I think, cultivate a certain potential cynicism and pessimism about the prospects for a livable future.
I can see what you mean by how the singularity of the comet and the way that it comes from just its own space then obscures how there is a geography of climate change. It is unequal.
In its impacts, right.
In its impacts, in its sources, you know, Jason Hickel's book that I talked about last year, Less is More, How Degrowth Will Save the World, points at how the global north, meaning Europe and the United States, but also Japan and Australia, bear the lion's share of climate change causing activity. Even when it's sourced from the global south, it's happening in the global south, because of the imperial dynamics of the global north. And that is not clear in this movie. There's some moments where, you know, they're talking about where the comet's going to land. At first, before the comet was going to be blown up, it was expected to land off of the shore of South America. And when they end up blowing up the comet in order to try and harvest the materials from it, it ends up fanning out the comet like a shotgun across the globe. And that is also kind of obscuring how it's still falling on the global south. It's not now everybody's problem because we're all in the same boat. Like, we live, it's a big boat, and, you know, there's many different parts of it. And the ruling classes have created these seals, these emergency seals called nation states between the different regions of the globe, and they want to police them. It's why the wall is such a big deal to the right-wing movement in this country. It is about the possible response to the eco crises that are unconsciously, you know, recognized, but then consciously denied.
The film has been praised by many scientists, and that's kind of an interesting aspect of the film. And, you know, you can't walk a block in my neighborhood without seeing a Believe Science sign along with Black Lives Matter. Clearly, the way in which science has been held hostage by the right and the anti-science dominates the right wing. I also think science is a more complicated world than simply Believe Science. So if I had to pick a side, I would pick Believe Science. But I think it's interesting that the film enlists astronomers to establish its scientific credentials, which I think is fine. But there are many claims, including the work of Timothy Morton and his cognitive psychology that seems to inform McKay to some extent, is, I think, wrong in many ways. And that may be a discussion for another day, but how much humans have evolved in a way that limits their ability to grasp the climate crisis, which is McKay's point, and I think informed the choice of the comet as a metaphor. In some ways, the cynicism of the film is not in poking fun at the public. I agree, you're right, that most of the parody is of people in power in the media. But I do think the comic skills and the writing skills that are evident in this film could be turned to something closer to the actual crisis we face, and that humans are able to grasp the seriousness, even as diffuse as it is and as complex as it is, in sizable numbers. There's a majority of people in this country and around the world that either express alarm or extreme concern about the climate crisis itself and understand many of the forces driving it.
Yeah, we heard last week on Sojourner Truth on KBOO, some folks who had written a publication called Hoodwinked in the Hot House, which stresses indigenous traditional knowledge and social practice perspective in climate mitigation. And what I find interesting in Hoodwinked in the Hot House is they emphasize public interest science. And something the film is offering a glimpse on is this difference between public interest and corporate interest science, that the scientists come from this state college. They are very kind of podunk. They're from Michigan, for crying out loud. And they've got these podunky accents. And whenever they are in communication about the comet, there is often a reference made to, like, oh, they're only from a state school, or we need to get these corporate or Ivy League scientists to give us the results or say what we want. And that there's a tradition of just demonizing science on the left, but there's also been a tradition of, like, reclaiming science and of recognizing that it is actually power that belongs to the public and that is necessary for the public to respond to these huge issues, that we need traditional knowledge, we need scientific knowledge that is gained and pursued for the public interest.
Yeah, and there's always a question of who are the experts. And I think to the extent that this championed the hero in this was largely, and the less corrupted one, was the young woman astronomy graduate student from, you know, from Michigan State University. She's kind of closer to everyday people. She's a woman. And actually, astronomy has been a very male-dominated field. So she represented kind of the emerging voices of women in male-dominated areas of science. But I think there's always this question, who are the experts? Who are the people who can most effectively document the trajectory of the problem of the climate crisis? And in my own work, I've been interested in frontline communities as experts in documenting the effects of climate emergency for some time. And so it's not only university-based scientists, whether state schools or elite schools, that speak to these effects. And I think the film does kind of open up that question in interesting ways. Who are the legitimate scientists that correctly diagnose the problems we face?
Okay, Jan, now that we're off air, we can be a bit more loosey-goosey about this.
I mean, I was ambivalent about this film because it was pleasurable to watch. It was funny and pointed, you know, and in smart ways. There was the touching theme of the young woman scientist who was supported by her professor, and there was no kind of physical exploitation of her. She had a standing of her own, and the relationship, a male professor and his woman student, was interesting and speaking to kind of possibilities for supportive relationships that don't involve that kind of sexual exploitation. She was inspiring, and I think the ways in which she was chastened to be more, to get more media training. Many of us worked in this field around the climate issue kind of resonate with that. How do you make this problem palatable? And I think the film Don't Look Up kind of had its cake and ate it too. That it has been discussed and very, you know, it has record views on Netflix. Millions of people are watching it. And I think both because it's fun and funny, but also takes up one of the most serious problems of our time. I think it's, in some ways, it's guilty of the problem it critiques. It throws a lot of famous actors at you. There's just a lot going on the screen. I didn't feel unsettled by it.
Yeah, I heard something on KBOO that I appreciated, where somebody referred to like how the film is perhaps preaching to the choir, and it's doing something very important in doing that. It's not indulgent. It is trying to rejuvenate a movement of people in a segment of society that are hearing the craziest things, that and are gaslit, and not just by like their fellow, but by a corporate campaign that is trying to leverage all manner of culture and media, deny what we're doing to the world and really to each other. And for people who already don't need to be convinced that they are putting their energy in all of that. And I don't think that can be discounted as just kind of like preaching to the choir, like an indulgence. It's a necessary kind of care labor, if you want to look at it that way, to offer that relief.
And I think the benefits of preaching to the choir should not be underestimated, because the choir is very tired and often sing and often has performs with too limited a set of notes. I think we do need to think about how to approach the climate emergency in ways that are effective. And certainly humor is part of that. But I do think there's a potential in this film for tremendous cynicism of the hell with it. There's nothing we can do about it. Let's party on. We're all doomed anyway, which is one message of the film. Or hold those dear, near and dear to you very close.
Well, I think the film is trying to attach the possibility of that cynicism to the privilege of those creating the situation, knowing that they've got an escape ship, and that it's not just nihilism because we're accepting that we're going to die. This guy thinks he's going to live forever and builds a ship to get away from Earth and takes, you know, however many dozens of people with him to reseed some Earth-like planet. And I think that in presenting a lot of this cynical stuff, we're also being presented with like either how it's optional, it's not just given, it's connected to the interests or perspective of certain actors in the situation or in society, and that we don't have to bear that.
Yeah, so it's certainly a film worth watching for the discussions it's generated. And if it revives some of the libido of the climate justice movement, Hooray, so be it. I'm all for that. But I think I'm not as enthused as you are about the film, or more cautious about it. But it's certainly worth seeing.